money and markets, the Islamist forces in the northern Iraq have seized more territory in Syria and Iraq, and it's causing the Iraqi government to accelerate, to ask the U.S. to accelerate delivery of military hardware, and it's sending the oil price higher. The best performing stocks right now are energy stocks, and that's in no small part thanks to that. That oil price is up. It's good news for Russia, which, of course, is very dependent on oil revenues, and it's making the Chinese deal and the prices thereof look very prescient. If you really want to understand what all this fight is about, I put up a great map that's up on the blog, and it shows the countries that are in the WTO and not in the WTO. And if you go back to that Sir James Goldsmith video that I just keep begging all of you to watch, it's Sir James Goldsmith interview with Charlie Rose in 1994. It's up on the blog. You can just do a search. What you'll see is you've got the sort of global empire trying to get everybody into the WTO basket. That's part of getting everybody into the central banking warfare basket. One of the shepherds trying to herd them in is, of course, NATO. And it's very interesting. I paired with that map an article. The president of the Dutch auditors, unbelievably brave woman, nailed NATO this month for billions missing, and before being asked to, the Netherlands and other countries in Europe being asked to pony up more money for NATO, they're saying, where is the money? A question we've been asking in this country for many years, where is the money? There is billions missing, not just on NATO, there's billions missing in Iraq. Of course, there's billions missing from the federal government. It's really, really important for all of us. You see the countries that are trying to slow down or stop this, you know, this move to get everybody in the model. And as I've said before, and I'll keep saying again, the minute that every country is in the model, you're going to have a serious tipping point and the change will really accelerate and kind of rock our world. And it's not inevitable. It's not inevitable at all. There's quite a squabble going on over those last 10 countries. And I should say 10 or so. Washington reels as House's leadership, Republican leader Eric Cantor, loses to a professor from Randolph-Macon University. That loss was in the Virginia primaries. The vote, I think, was 36 to 20,000, so 11,000 people prior, or actually it's less than that, but approximately 10,000 people have literally revolutionized the House Republican leadership. One of Cantor's, or this is in part attributed to his sort of moderate view on immigration and offering amnesty to people who are already here. This is going to be, if I had to guess, I would say that there is a significant chance that the professor David Bratt, who won, had significant help from the Clinton Democratic side. If you look at who just got appointed as the new Secretary of HUD and is being sort of held out as somebody to be a vice presidential candidate on a Clinton ticket, and if you look at what the Clintons needed to do to sort of out-position themselves against Jeb Bush, one of his strongest credentials, of course, his wife is Mexican and his children are basically half Mexican, and he has a great story to tell on the immigration, and one that's very effective coming from a Republican. And so we see, I think, the Democrats pushing back with this new HUD appointment, somebody being bred up for a very effective vice president candidate, and now a real effort to make it difficult for the Republican leadership to take sort of smart political positions on immigration and immigration reform, which was really being teed up to be done this year or next. So it wouldn't surprise me if there's a deeper story here. I do think in part it does reflect the frustration of the voters. There has this candidate, Bratt, made a real effort to go door to door, and that's what it takes. And what we're going to discover this year is we're looking for a significant shift. Now, interestingly enough, Clinton made an absolutely dreadful mistake on national TV. She was being interviewed and questioned about her speaking fees. Her new book is out with huge money, clearly not coming from sales. This is kind of sort of how you launder money to people in a legal way. And She was asked about her speaking fees and claimed that she had come out of the White House when she and Bill Clinton left the White House dead broke. I put up a link to one of the Politico articles explaining why that just is not, in fact, the case. But it's a perfect example of someone who, in her world, you know, dead broke has a very different meaning than it has to people who live in places like Hickory Valley, Tennessee, where I live. And what is so important to me about this comment is I was stunned to see it happen that Clinton, after all the years and effort of trying to advance politically and running a Senate campaign and running a presidential campaign, still doesn't know not to say that and to say that in that way, and still doesn't understand the worlds, sort of the different worlds that she's pitching to. And what that tells me is literally the two worlds and the two fields have moved so far apart. It's like the poem from Yeats where he says, the center cannot hold. And it tells me that Clinton has not got a clue about what is going on the ground in this country and how to speak to people. And it tells me that trying to get her position for a serious presidential candidate, it could be a lot harder than anybody thinks and really may not be possible. It's a stunning, stunning mistake, and tells me that she may be too far trapped in 2.0 to ever make it across the chasm. Part of the challenge of this sort of 2.0 to 3.0 dynamic is the old spin and tricks aren't working. And you kind of see people like Clinton sort of floundering when it doesn't work and they can't get it. A book review out on Matt Taibbi's new book, The Divide, it's very much worth reading. Taibbi is a great writer, and nobody has done as good a job as he at sort of illuminating the outrageous injustice of the double standards that are going on right now in the economy and corruption. Where I always get frustrated with Taibbi is he won't, of course, look under the rug and say what is really going on. You know, he really protects himself by sticking with what he can document very close up, which is fine. That's what, you know, that kind of reporter does. But sometimes I think that he and Green will do us all a terrible disservice by not being willing to face sort of the deeper issues under the rug. But that leaves that job for other people. Like the kind of researchers who are showing up at the Secret Space Program. But nevertheless, it's an outstanding book and very helpful. There's a great chapter on a group of hedge funds targeting an insurance company, and it shows you the kind of tactics that are used against a business that were used against my business. And if you run a business in America, you want to read this chapter. You need to understand that these things happen. You need to see how they work. Taibbi does a great job of sort of communicating the whole way these things go down and sort of that kind of an economic warfare. And it's really a marvelous thing. So if you're in business in America, you need to read this. The other reason to read the book is because enforcement is becoming a bigger and bigger business. The sheriff of Nottingham is absolutely let loose on the land. And Taibbi describes it being done to poor people, but that model is moving up and eating its way through the middle class. And it really pays to sort of see how it works, understand it, and understand the care with which you have to navigate this environment if you wake up and find yourself dealing with one of those situations, which can happen to anybody. If it can happen to me, it can happen to anybody. I also put up a commentary this week, The Expensive Illusion of Healthcare. What's happening at the VA is very relevant because it describes a system where a lot of promises have been made, but the funding hasn't been provided. And rather than admit you're not going to get the service, they hold out the promise that you're going to get service. And so there is terrible loss of time and resources, life, as you keep trying to get the service, but it doesn't come through. And it's very important to see that because that model is what's going to be applied in what I've been talking about for Obamacare. We're all going to pay lots of money to the insurance, and then we're going to show up to get the service. And rather being told, oh, guess what, you know, it's not here, we'll get put on waiting lists, and the thing will go, you know, and it's sort of the 26-step process that I've seen very many times. And I would encourage you to read that article because I want you to see what's coming way ahead of time. And I don't want you to lose time or money on the illusion that it will be there when it won't be there. Because if you know that, if you know it's an illusion, then you can make other plans. And that's that can be a much more successful strategy. We had a great interview with Jeffrey Smith last week about the sort of tipping point being reached in when it comes to fresh food and GMO. Very inspiring. I wanted to read something from a investment newsletter apropos. Here it goes. Is it just coincidence the leaders in the fast casual dining segment, virtually the only segment of the restaurant industry showing consistently high growth, are also the ones that seemingly care the most about the quality and integrity of the food they serve their customers? Both Panera Bread and Chipotle Mexican Grill have committed their companies to sourcing ingredients from only the most wholesome suppliers who themselves promise to uphold certain standards. 2 months ago, Chipotle expanded its food with integrity policy by promising it will be completely GMO-free by year's end. And last week, Panera said it's redoubling its effort to serve clean ingredients, offer a menu that's transparent, and working with suppliers, organizations, and governments to make, quote, positive impact on the world. So clearly the consumer is making themselves heard, and the more we can prove that we can do this, the more areas it can be done in. I think part of the shift to 2.0 and 3.0 is that dynamic is going to accelerate. There's an old saying that says, sell in May and go away. You've heard me talk about it very many times, that the majority of profits in the U.S. equity markets come between November and the end of May. Well, market went higher. Just, you know, we are so overdue for a 10 or 20% correction that as the market went higher, everyone was kind of baffled. Of course, we're coming into another round of earnings announcements in July, and it's hard to fathom that the markets can keep pushing up. So far for the year, the S&P is up 6%. The emerging markets are up 5%. Gold's up 5%. So it's kind of when I talked with Franklin this morning, and you can hear that interview for this week's Salera report, is kind of a sideways market. The star performer, Treasury, long Treasuries are up 10%. That takes my breath away, because, of course, we saw interest rates rise. We're expecting this to be the turn and finally after the long bull market and bonds coming to an end. But if anything, we expected interest rates to continue to rise as the Fed tapers. But no. Fed, I think, is really worried about employment. And so the long Treasury interest rates down, long Treasury up 10%. It has been the star performer. Big question is, will the emerging markets start to turn up here? Hard to imagine. The dollar seems to hold steady. But of course, the divergence between the emerging markets and the U.S. equity markets have been so extraordinary. There's a great story up that we put up on Monday in Money and Markets called Global Valuations, and it makes the case that at the current price earnings ratio and yields, the emerging markets are very, very attractive on a long-term basis. Not surprisingly, with the strength in market, we get the announcement up on the blog, global private wealth rises to $152 trillion. Of course, the big question, if you look at any part in the emerging markets or the markets, the big question has been China. I did an interview several weeks ago with USA Watchdog, where I said the big question was, how would China fare? China's growth is slowed tremendously. They have debt problems and terrible pollution problems and are going through a period of reform. How that works will be very, very important. Joseph Meyer, lovely guy from Wall Street who I met through Coast to Coast, he's another Coast to Coast regular, made me an offer to swap our newsletter. So he gave me a copy of a Straight Money analysis. It's up on the blog for subscribers only. Lots of great chart and ideas. Check it out. I think it's really interesting.